Yep, I'm in my bunker, but I'm not sure it would help me if anything like this ever happened. We are talking with Bob Gleason, End of Days. We'll be back with more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Bob Gleason, End of Days. Bob, in my day, you take your best client out to dinner and you take them out and you show them a good time. We are China's biggest customer, yet so many people believe China wants to annihilate us, wants to attack us. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know that if we stop buying China's merchandise and we stopped basically we are their number one customer, like you said, that the China would go through a very serious financial reversal. I don't know if there's some point if they got angry enough. I suppose theoretically they could stop buying our dollars and all that, but you know they'd suffer financially, from it. They'd suffer terribly from it.
All right, let's talk a little bit about North Korea. You haven't mentioned North Korea much. Are they a threat? Are they a threat to give some of their, enriched uranium and other materials to some rogue?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the problems with that is if you really want to give it away and then somebody uses it, the nuclear forensics are not foolproof, but they're pretty good. And we would test the fingerprints of the radiation after the bomb burst, and we'd have a pretty good idea that it came from North Korea. Ideally, if North Korea wanted to nuke us, they would try to steal some Russian bomb fuel and try to nuke us with that, and then the fingerprint would be on Russia. But yeah, they could do. The kind of stuff that really bothers me right now is that there was a guy, he was an Al Qaeda operative named Sharif Moabli, and he was busted in Yemen. And when he was caught, he killed one of the Yemen police, and he wounded several others. He's a tough guy. You know what he'd been doing in the United States before he went to Yemen? He had worked and trained in 5 American nuclear power plants.
Oh, great!
And we're talking before about these guys, these Al Qaeda Taliban units, are blowing up Pakistani nuclear facilities. And I think part of the reason they hate the Pakistani government so much is they think that they're too cooperative with the United States government, and they blew up Pakistan's biggest most heavily secured army installation, the actual army headquarters, they've been blowing up their biggest naval bases. And now we have one of these Al Qaeda that was working and training in five U.S. nuclear power plants.
Are we stupid, Bob, or what?
Yeah, I mean we're doing nothing to upgrade the security. The Indian government's trying to upgrade their security. They're scared to death, and and also a part of it's the media. You never hear the name Sharif Moabli in the American media. They never talk about how he worked at five U.S. nuclear power plants, and we ignore stuff like this at our peril.
Even though End of Days is a novel, it's based on some real facts and things that could happen. Do we have in this country some kind of group or organization that is established especially and only to deal with problems like this?
Not really. I work with a lot of military authors.
Yes,
and
sir.
Over the years, some of them are quite highly placed. And over the years, I've asked them if they could find any studies from the Pentagon on nuclear terrorism. I said, I don't want, don't violate anything classified. Part of my research would be interesting to look at some Pentagon studies. Nobody's ever been able to find a Pentagon study on nuclear terrorism. And somebody once said to me, I asked them why, and they said, "Oh, it's too frightening. The subject's too frightening." And I said, "Well, that's crazy, that because it's frightening, that therefore we don't defend against it." And my own feeling is that nuclear terrorism is the nullification of strategy and tactics. It's the reductio ad absurdum of warfare. And consequently, you know, the American government doesn't want to study it. There is a study on the effects of nuclear bomb. Pentagon study on the effects of a nuclear bomb detonation. And there was a book written about it called City on Fire by a person named Eden, was their last name. And you know who was left out of the Pentagon study of nuclear bomb bursts?
What's that?
This will come as a surprise to you and me, but there's no fire in any nuclear bomb. The firestorms killed more than 50% was responsible for more than 50% of the fatalities at Hiroshima. But in the Pentagon study, there's no fire in the effects. And one of the conclusions from City on Fire was that the Pentagon is the nuclear weapons are really frightening, and the Pentagon just doesn't want people to know how truly frightening these weapons are. But by the way, you know, we were talking before about how easy it is to cobble, you know, a Paris Hiroshima style nuke together.
Yeah.
But there's actually a simpler way of doing it. If you don't want to get a piece of old cannon barrel in that, you can get a chunk of highly enriched, you know, bomb grade uranium. And you get a size about the size of a very large grapefruit, about 100 pounds. And you drop it from a height of 6 feet on another chunk about the size of a very large grapefruit, 100 pounds. You get 50% of the Hiroshima yield.
Just from that?
Yeah, just from dropping a height of 6 feet. Dropping one grapefruit onto another grapefruit, you'll get 50% of the Hiroshima.
So it's the compression, the smashing that really triggers this, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's a tremendous mass. I mean, this is, you know, one of the densest materials in the universe, and so it's a big chunk. If you were to blast one piece into another piece inside a piece of howitzer barrel, that, you know, you'd have a lot less than 200 pounds, way less. You know,
yeah, that's right. How much does speed have to do with it, Bob?
The speed is very important. And by the way, when I describe, you know, blasting it inside the cannon barrel, I am leaving out one step. If somebody tried to do it the way I described it, the mere touching of it would cause of the two pieces would cause it to grow critical. But it would not. There's an extra step that would have to be done to make it.
Are not mentioning.
I'm not mentioning.
Because of concerns.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't blame you.
I think people say, well, what can we do about this sort of thing? I think what you're doing, George, is, you know, just to get people talking about it. And just to say, well, it's scary, and I don't want to talk about it. Well, I'm sorry. You know, the Pentagon has an obligation to study this stuff. It really does.
There's no question about it. We should have the Senate, the Congress, should be on the floor tomorrow holding your book up in the air saying, we need to do something about this because it's possible. Not because it will happen, because it's possible, and we need to be able to prevent it the best way we can. You know, with our incredible technology— I would hope that we would have some kind of detection devices all around this country, and I bet we don't, do we?
No, we don't have enough. There is one problem, and you're absolutely right, and it would be helpful to, certainly detecting, plutonium bomb fuel. The highly enriched uranium bomb fuel does not give off gamma rays; it gives off alpha rays. Your skin will actually block alpha rays. You could theoretically hold a chunk of highly enriched nuclear bomb fuel in your hand and not get radiation poisoning from it. You could theoretically put it in your shirt pocket and carry it around. It might rip your shirt pocket out. It's pretty heavy, and it might be a little warm. But the alpha rays won't penetrate your skin, and so that if somebody had a chunk of highly enriched bomb grade uranium, that I'm not sure how effective, you know, the detectors would be. They would be more effective with plutonium bomb fuel, which, by the way, if you picked it up and held in your hands, it'd kill you because it has the gamma rays that would immediately penetrate everything. Somebody once said if you wanted to smuggle this stuff into the United States, that you know, you get a container full of toilets and smuggle it in the toilets, so the porcelain in the toilets would actually block the rays.
Unbelievable. What do you suggest Americans who are listening to this program right now, Canadians who are listening, people worldwide who are listening, and they're concerned? What can the average person do?
I think the nations that have been, you know, the most outspoken in their desire to get, you know, nuclear bomb fuel and use it against us have been the Middle Eastern nations. I'd go out and get some kind of a hybrid automobile and stop using so much gasoline at the gas pump. I think that would be, you know, that.
Like
you said about the and there have been, you know, Senator Byron Dorgan, you know, gave me a very nice blurb on the book, and said, William Cohn, who had been Clinton's defense secretary, and he'd been a senator for many years. He's helped me with the book, and there are senators out there. Senator Richard Lugar is one of the guys that put together the Nuclear Threat Initiative. And he's been very active in trying to, you know, to secure Russia's loose nukes. I mean, he's been really, he really should have won a Nobel Prize by now. And I would contact Senator Richard Lugar, and the Edward Markey in the Congress has been from Massachusetts. Massachusetts congressman, he's been very active on the subject. There are people out there but the number one thing is to try to, you know, get, like you said, that, you know, that the congressmen, the senators need to talk about this. The generals need to get involved in it. The fact, you know, what we were talking about, the sheer absurdity of it, that we got this guy, Sharif Moabli, who trained a hardcore al-Qaeda killer, who killed and wounded several, Yemeni security officers when he was finally arrested and apprehended. You know, he trained in five U.S. nuclear power plants. I mean, they clearly want to blow up Indian Point, you know, which is, you know, on the edge of New York City, and that, you know, we're doing nothing to upgrade the security. This is, in fact, in the media won't even carry these stories.
How many nuke plants do we have in this country? 120 something.
104.
Like that? 104. How many troops would you station at each one for some kind of reasonable protection? 50?
You figure that, you know, that you're going to get hit with, you know, 20-25 assailants, and you figure they're going to have platter charges, they're going to have rocket propelled grenades, they're going to have, you know, almost all the scenarios for this is there's at least one trusted insider. Now, in the case of Sharif Moabli, that trusted insider would have been Sharif Moabli, obviously. But you get a guy on the inside that, you know, helping the terrorists, and that's a huge, huge advantage.
You would think after 9/11, regardless of how, what, or your belief system about that horrible day, regardless of that, you would think that we would have immediately started to do something with heavy security. I mean, I remember, for example, they banned flights around these plants and things like that, but they should have immediately said, look, we're going to take 50 troops at 104 of these facilities. That's 5,000 some people, and soldiers, and we're going to protect these facilities. And
You know what they did after 9/11? They used the nuclear power plants. They used to run. I mentioned before that they'd run these tests where they would, you know, some guys to see if they could sneak into the plant and, you know, and occupy the control room, you know, for 20 minutes or so. The Bush administration stopped running those tests after 9/11. They said, "Oh, 9/11 was so bad that we're going to be so diligent about security now that we no longer have to test our security systems." So they stopped doing these mock intrusion tests.
We could take 5,000 troops.
Yeah.
Take 5,000 troops that are in Iraq right now and station them around these nuke plants.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah, you know that the name Sharif Moabli, it ought to be like somebody ought to go and do a big special. 60 Minutes ought to do a big special on him. You know, and why isn't that, you know, why aren't we defending our plants against guys like him who the gauntlet's been thrown down? You know, they want to take those plants out, and they're already doing it in Pakistan. They're blowing up Pakistan's nuclear facilities, and that they've got guys who've been training in our own nuclear power plants. But you know, why is the 60 Minutes doing a piece on this?
Well, maybe they'll know. Maybe they'll do it now. Maybe one of their producers says, you know, That's how things happen. That's how your History Channel event started.
George, you made me a TV star. The History Channel, some History Channel people heard me on your show, and then they asked me to star in a 2-hour special, Prophets of Doom, where I talked about nuclear terrorism.
Do you get some people who tell you privately, ah, come on, Bob, you're being overreaction here. Come on, it's not going to be that bad.
The response I've gotten, I told you I work with a lot of military guys.
Yeah.
And a number of them, I try to talk to them about it. You know, they'd pick up their drink and walk into another room. They'd just walk away.
They just don't want to hear this because it upsets
really
them so much.
About. I'm sorry, what?
Because it upsets them so much.
I think they feel that there's nothing they can do about it, and it's a sense of they feel a sense of impotence and apathy, you know. But there is stuff that we can do. There's a lot of stuff. We could secure Indian Point. My God, you know, we could stop guys from going in with Home Depot garden carts and stealing stuff out of Los Alamos. You know, we could try to do something to make foreign storage sites more secure, and you know, in the end, try to figure out how we can reduce the quantity of bomb fuel. You know,
End of Days just came out, right?
Yep. It hit front of store at the big bookstores. It just hit it today, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Well, we're going to take some calls with you in just a moment, Bob Gleason. So, as you look at all of this, if you could fix one thing right now, what would it be? Station troops at our plants?
I would. If I really had a magic wand, I would try to figure out how to. Why do we have so many tons upon tons of nuclear bomb fuel worldwide? You know, I would try to figure out how to get reprocess it into something. In the end. This may be another conversation, but if you really wanted to stop nuclear proliferation, the problem is that nuclear power reactors are, in fact, nuclear bomb fuel factories.
Yes,
and
they are.
Nuclear power has never really made any financial sense. It's just the startup costs, not the long-term costs, which are astronomical. The startup costs are typically 1,000% higher than those of a gas turbine power plant. All nuclear power plants are basically socialistic in nature. The governments have to basically pay for everything, whereas a gas turbine power plant, the private industry would pay for that. Uh-huh. But you wonder why do so many governments worldwide want to own nuclear power plants, given that they're financial black holes? And the reason being is, You're never more than 6 months away from having nuclear bomb fuel if you have the nuclear power.
Well, and maybe that's what they want. Bob, we're going to take some phone calls with you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. Our special guest tonight, Bob Gleason. We're talking about End of Days, a book that should hit the New York Times bestseller list. We'll be back. We'll take your calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Bob Gleason, End of Days. Bob, knowing what you know, is it easy for you to sleep? Are you worried about this? I mean, what's happening with you?
Oh, I can be pessimistic about certain things in the and out there in the real world. My own life is, I've been blessed. You know, I'm a book editor, a book publisher. Oh, I love my work. You know, I'm doing some interesting television work now. You know, I write a book a year. You know, and I have, you know, I have a lot of great friends, and you know, I have, you know, I have a very good life. And but you know, I distinguish between trying to look at certain problems and try to figure out what to do about them. That, you know, that that's the, you know, that, you know, you try to be objective about that stuff. And no, I try, you know, I try not to let it affect my personal life.
Okay, yeah, let's take some calls here, Bob. Let's pick it up by going to Angelo in the city of New York. In New York. Hey, Angelo, go ahead. First time caller.
How you doing, Bob? How you doing, George?
Good, sir.
Pretty good. How are you doing?
First of all, I want to make a comment about the Indian Point nuclear plant. I take a client there who has an architectural firm in the shadow of the plant, and I usually wait for him in a parking lot that I can literally throw a rock from that parking lot and hit nuclear plant.
Jeez.
Very, very close to public access. There should be at least 50 soldiers out there with machine guns and tanks protecting it at all times.
Well, and it's also in a bad because the winds come down the Hudson River. It also, yeah. Very frequently, you know, that the natural winds would tend to target New York City too.
Exactly. Also,
and by the way, you know how much water Indian Point uses a day? As much as 2.5 billion gallons of water a day from the Hudson River. The amount of water it takes to cool down, if something like that starts to melt down, the amount of water it takes is just almost inconceivable to cool
it down. It'll probably be released right back into the Hudson and flow down into the Atlantic Ocean.
Absolutely.
Also, my question is that if a airliner were to crash into a nuclear plant like Indian Point or a Limerick outside of Philadelphia, what would be the devastation? Would that be able to trigger a nuclear reaction?
Yeah, it would. In fact, there's a new generation of nuclear reactors that's being made by Westinghouse, which is owned by Toshiba in Japan. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is always, you know, attacked for being soft on the industry, is supposed to regulate, has actually said that most of the reactors cannot survive being hit by an airliner. They had insisted that the new generation be strong enough to survive a strike by an airliner, and it's not. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission actually attacked this new generation of reactors. But yeah, your answer is no, that the nuclear power plants can't withstand a strike by an airliner.
Bob, who's the hero in End of Days?
There's a lot of characters. That the heroine of it is, I think, is Kate Magruder at the end. There's a number of very strong characters, some of who did not survive. I have one character. It's been pointed out that I have a thing. I've done it in several of my books. I'll have talking animals in my books. You know, they have interior monologues, and they end up very heroic, and they save the lives of protagonists, and they're it's just something I do. And I do have a talking rat named Sailor, who, among other things, thinks he's Odysseus, and he recites poetry, and he sings, and he's very noble. And he will save Kate Magruder's life 3 different times. And the Publishers Weekly described him as the book's true hero, but he's actually a little. But it's just something I've done over the years. I like to have talking animals, and Wrath of God. I had a talking Triceratops, and you know.
Well, Hitchcock would include himself in his films. You have a little talking animal in your books.
Yeah, I always have an animal.
Let's go to Melissa driving around in Ohio, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Melissa. You're on with Bob Gleason.
Morning, George. Morning, Bob. How are you getting
along? Hi, Melissa.
Okay. Back in the 80s, if I'm correct, is when the FDA knocked out lead out of paint. Am I correct?
I couldn't hear that last. Knocked out what?
Yeah. I don't know if it was the 80s, but you're right. They sure did.
Now, that's basically with the nuclear coming up so high in volume in the 80s, and the FDA sitting there taking away the one and only thing of lead that can actually protect a person. You know, children aren't going to eat wood and paint off of a wall. Why would they take away the one thing that we could protect ourselves from a nuclear blast?
Lead-lined houses or something? I couldn't quite understand that.
Would lead save us from a blast? Shield us? I'm not sure, Bob.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how you build lead into the, you turn the house into a lead-lined bomb shelter or something. I don't quite understand that.
I don't think anything would save us from a blast.
No.
It
would melt pretty near anything. The initial temperature of a bomb going off is several million degrees, and it creates just the sheer destructive force of it. It would create the fireball, would destroy pretty near, if a Hiroshima-style bomb went off in Times Square, the fireball would and the blast would destroy pretty near everything in a radius of 1 mile. That what happens is you get a blast wave that just is just tremendous. It just knocks down everything in about a square mile. It leaves a kind of a vacuum, and everything gets sucked in, and suddenly you have then the fireball hits and starts to levitate. But you have all these blasted, exposed surfaces the fireball sets everything on fire, and you get like a pumping up and down motion as the fireball rises up. And the people talk about weapons of mass destruction. There's only one weapon of mass destruction, and that's a nuclear weapon. It's the only one that destroys people and structures and property en masse, to that degree. There's nothing in the world that compares to it. And as you said, George, there's really nothing. If you're within a couple of miles of the epicenter, that you're basically gone.
You remember that film we saw, Bob, when we were kids, and it was done testing when we did our nuke testing of the mannequin family and the little house and all that. And I mean, it's just boom, it's gone. And I always remember the picture of all these people, all these scientists with their sunglasses on, looking at it. We really, in those days, had no idea what this would do, did we?
No, and there's Robert J. Liston has written about it, referred to them as nuclear messiahs, and there were people there. The most notable was Edward Teller, that just absolutely loved nukes. Curtis LeMay did too. There's a piece in LeMay's memoir where he waxes rhapsodic as he describes all the bomb power in a B-52, and he equates it with and he describes all the different kinds of firepower and all the wars throughout history, going through World War One, going through the Civil War, the Crusades. He goes all the way back to the Stone Age, of people that were throwing rocks and sticks at each other. And he talks about how that one plane has more firepower than all the war machines in the history of the world. And then he says at the end of the speech, he said, let them go off, let them all blow, and let the stars, stare down on us in awe, like that. Edward Teller wanted to have night strikes at the moon, and he wanted to send nuclear tipped rockets and set off, nuclear detonations on the moon so we could all watch them at night. And he thought about how beautiful it would be. He tried to use nuclear weapons to excavate some natural gas deposits in one of the western states. Needless to say, that ground you can't go near, so radioactive you can't go near it. He just basically rendered many square miles completely radioactive in the process. But people, they really saw nuclear weapons is almost holy.
Yeah.
And of course, in Pakistan, in India, that they really do kind of. I think the Indian bomb was named the Smiling Buddha. A.Q. Khan really saw that the Pakistani bomb as a kind of salvation.
Well, it brought them into a different age, and they were all patting themselves on the back. I'm convinced, Bob, based on some of our past guests, that historically we've gone through this before. I think the Indian texts will show you that, you know, they talk in terms of an atomic bomb, something happened. And isn't it true that Oppenheimer picked up information from the ancient texts about the possibility of this?
Well, he said, Oppenheimer compared himself to a god. You know, he said, I am Shiva, the shatterer of worlds. And by the way, I quote a lot of those texts and throughout End of Days. That I have a character, Sister Cassandra, who's one of my favorite characters, who is she writes songs about the apocalypse, and she's a famous singer, and she's got her own TV radio show. But she also gives sort of like sermons in which she quotes quite frequently from the ancient Indian texts and Nostradamus, all kinds of things.
Why did this take you 28 years to do?
Well, I got I did other things. You know, I have a full-time job and all that. But the it was something I was haunted by. And I mentioned before that all the great religions and mythologies, they have a Genesis myth and an end time myth. It was an important story. And also that there was a dearth of material, particularly on nuclear terrorism, and that fascinated me too. That, you know, I had to do so much, you know, research to find and putting things together and connecting dots and, you know, picking up little pieces of information here and there. And it finally inspired me. Next year, I'm coming out with a nonfiction book on nuclear terrorism. I've never found a really good nonfiction book on nuclear terrorism, so I finally decided to write one myself. But it was just, you know, I was kind of obsessed with it. I had commissioned and edited a book by two friends of ours, Larry Niven and Jerry Purnell, called Lucifer's Hammer, was about a comet that swings by the sun, and it's held together. There's five mountains of nickel the size of Mount Everest. And when the comet swings by the sun, the sun melts the ice, which is holding these metallic mountains together, and the comet hits the Earth, and each of the these five mountains hits each of the five oceans, and it cracks the Earth's mantle, and the bazillions of tons of salt water come up, which the molten magma from the Earth, from the core of the Earth, vaporizes zillions of tons of salt water, which come down in temperate regions of saltwater rain, destroying the topsoil, and comes down in polar regions of snow and ice, creating an ice age. And Lucifer's Hammer was simply the most overpowering novel I'd ever laid eyes on. And I'd read other things too, and I'd read The Stand, and and later on I read, you know, Left Behind. And I had a vision for writing a really, really powerful, gutsy, you know, novel. And it was just, you know, something that haunted me and kind of drove me. And I put an amazing, at one point, the novel ballooned up to 3,500 pages, and I had to cut it by 70%. A lot of characters in it. But I've been gratified that the critical reception, the booklist basically said is the best end of the world novel written, and it was a class by itself. And Publishers Weekly said it made Cormac McCarthy's The Road look like a quiet stroll through the park. You know? And I've written four apocalyptic novels all together, and it's a subject that haunts me.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Karen in Walsenburg, Colorado. Karen, welcome to the show. Hi.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
To answer your last caller's question, I think she was talking about radiation from fallout and the amount of lead paint, and the lead inside paint would do absolutely no good. It's not going to do any good. My question is, what do you think the possibility, since our southern border seems to be in such disarray and disrepair, that terrorist cells have already infiltrated it and maybe more are currently?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's supposed to be some Hezbollah on the southern border. I've read different accounts of that, and supposed to be helping out with the drug smuggling and whatever. But yeah, no, you're right. The southern border is notoriously porous.
Well, and again, I keep coming back to this possibility too, Bob, that it's not just the Middle Eastern type terrorist we've got to be concerned about. I'm really concerned about, you know, groups of people, power people, elitists who want to bring us down any way they can. And, you know, they've got their homes in Europe hidden away, tucked away and stuff. And I don't know. There's just a part of me that that thinks that's a strong possibility, too.
Well, Matt Taibbi claimed that he wrote a book called Griftocracy, and he claims that a lot of that we have, you know, a lot of financial people on Wall Street are sort of like the Saudi royals, you know, that they're getting big villas, you know, in other countries, and that they have just concluded that the United States is going to go down hard, and that, you know, they want to be able to, you know, flee the country when everything goes up. And the I know a lot of Wall Street guys, and Taibbi's observations are not that far fetched.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and the I think, you know, one of the things that we were talking before, and Oak Ridge did a study in 1977, and they demonstrated that if you have the equipment from an old dairy or an old winery, it takes you 6 months to build a nuclear bomb fuel reprocessor. And in 1 month, you can reprocess enough nuclear power plant waste to build the Nagasaki bomb. And that, you know, we talked before about how nuclear power plants are insanely expensive. You know, they're 1,000% the startup cost. Forget about what you do with the nuclear waste. Forget about what happens if one of them melts down. But just simply the startup costs. You know, nobody in private enterprise will touch that.
Oh,
and
no.
So, you know, the governments have to build these things. And, the you know, that it's fairly clear now that most nations are willing to spend these insane amounts of money because that they know they got a nuclear bomb fuel factory.
Yeah.
If they ever decide that they want to start, you know, cranking out nuclear bombs, you know, that they could, they're, you know, they're no more than 6 or 7 months away from doing that. And the right now that there are 16 nations in Africa and the Mideast that have plans to build nuclear power plants. And the position of the United Nations is that let them. That the mandate of the United Nations Atomic Energy Agency is that every nation on Earth, assuming that they're not, you know, run by genocidal maniacs, that every nation on Earth has an inalienable right to have a nuclear power plant. And as long as we have that attitude, that you're going to have limitless nuclear bomb fuel proliferation.
Well, you may be right about that, Bob Gleason. You may be right about that indeed. Why don't we put sensors around them like they have at Area 51 that can detect people at least a mile or two away coming up to the plant?
Absolutely. Why don't we?
50 soldiers, put some of the sensors around and do all kinds of things, barricade the area. You have to come through the special gates, everything else. Stay with us. Coming back for a final hour of phone calls with Bob Gleason. Those of you on hold from Houston and Bend, Oregon and Phoenix and the rest of you, we'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM.